Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. You're right, Jim?
Just a bow.
Merry Christmas. You're listening to this on Boxing Day. Of course,
we've recorded this. Merry Christmas, absolutely.
Yes, we've recorded
this. I've recovered by then.
Yeah, well, I'll be full of goose, I think. I think I'm cooking a goose.
Well, I know, but we're actually recording this in the middle of December, having had just a very fraught train ride.
Yeah.
Multiple train ride.
I thought it would be easy for you to get.
Oh, you'd have thought so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. But we are in the Buttery, which is the bar of St. Edmund Hall, Oxford, which is my alma mater.
Yeah, I know. And, it's fantastic. I can just picture you here in the bar.
With hair.
Roistering.
And Reg the barman.
Leading all the students a merry dance.
Well, yeah, and the beer was, I think, 84p a pint.
Yeah, you see, Webster's, you see, up north in Durham.
Yeah.
A pint of Webster's in the St. Chad's College bar is 50p.
Oh, really? That's it.
You could buy 16 pints for them, how much it costs a single pint in London. I mean, imagine, everyone was so generous at rounds back then.
But what we have in here is there are oars on the ceiling from the bumps mainly, and the men's torpids, and there's photographs of various teams, the gymnasts over there with just their shorts on, and a women's hockey team which overlaps from when I was here, with Claire Rhodes James in it, whose father was Richard Rhodes James, who wrote Chindit republished last year or the year before last.
Yeah,
but that's not why we're here. No. We're not here for me to reminisce, thank God.
Well, no, I'm quite up for it. I mean, particularly since we're in the bar.
No, we're here to talk. What's your full title? That's the thing we always have to do with academics.
My title is Fellow by Special Election in German.
There we go. We're here to talk.
Wow.
Fellow by Special Election in German. We're here to talk to Alex from the White Rose Project. Now,
does that mean you were specially elected in German, or?
Yeah, let's say that.
Actually, you know what? How would one say that in German? Because because that's
an eat sheet and leaves moment,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. How do you say your title in German, Alex?
Well, my title wouldn't exist in Germany.
Oh, right.
But I would be a Professorin or a Dozentin.
Oh, lovely. Oh, I love a bit German, don't you, Jim?
Not a general plenipotentiary of buffets, fair charbon.
Exactly. We're not going down that. What was it? The buffets,
buffets harbor,
buffets harbor, unterboot sand, whatever it is, untersand boot. Anyway. But we're here to talk about the White Rose Project, which is your study, your project, the book from the year before last that you wrote. We were just chatting before Jim got here about how you wrote that during the pandemic. So it's a work of not of the archive and the library, but of responding to the subject in itself. And I think what we could do, first of all, is talk about the White Rose in itself and then what the project is, but also your field of study. Jim, I haven't told you yet what Alex's field is. What's your field of study, Alex? Because we were talking about this a moment ago and it's just so cool.
Yeah, so I always feel like I should preface things by saying I'm not a historian. Which is not an apology, but from my discipline and my training, I'm not in history. I'm in German studies. So I'm a Germanist, which is a great German word that we've co-opted in English. Yeah, it's sehr gut.
Wow.
But basically,
what does that mean, though?
What it means is that I basically study the language and all the culture of Germany.
Wow. I've just been thinking so much about propaganda in the 1930s.
Well,
at the moment.
There's plenty to be getting on with in the language and culture of Germany.
Yes.
How long have you got?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the bar opens at 5, I think. But the White Rose in itself, what people may know about... because after all, what we're looking at here, what's really interesting about the White Rose is it's one of those things that exists in the popular imagination.
Yeah.
As much as it does in history. People know about Sophie Scholl. They've heard of her. They know the story roughly. If you watch a documentary about, you know, the Nazis in the Second World War, there will be a bit about the White Rose, about how they defied the Nazis, they printed their leaflets, and she's the symbol of it, which is interesting because it's her and five men, her brothers, their friends, and one of the professors at the university. Yet she's become the face of it, which I think is bound up in all sorts of things as well.
I've got to say that, you know, for all the kind of terrible horrors of the Second World War, one of the things that I find most traumatic is every time I see a photograph of Sophie Scholl looking sort of young and fresh-faced with her life ahead of her, and the thought of her being guillotined 4 days after arrested is just, it's so grotesque and so horrible and so traumatic.
Yeah, it's, you know, in many ways it's the banality of evil that Hannah Arendt talks about. And the sheer speed, I mean, the speed of the resistance activities themselves, you know, they start producing pamphlets in June 1942. By February, half of the core group is dead.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredibly quick. And it's incredibly quick from them being arrested. So Hans and Sophie Scholl were arrested on a Thursday in their university, you know, which is amazing to think of. We sit here in the bar in a university, you know, where I come in and work every day. The idea that you could just be in your university as a student on a Thursday, and by Monday, you're being guillotined.
Yeah, it's absolutely horrible. Yes. And, you know, I curse Jacob Schmidt.
Yes.
The maintenance man, the janitor.
Yeah.
The staff here are really nice, though, Joe. I just want to line. Just want to line at them. All the staff here at Teddy Hall are great people, and they're not the kind of people who would dob us in. I just want to, we need to get that out there right now. But yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating story, though, isn't it? Because there's a bigger group as well. It's not just the five of, or the six of them. It's not just the core group. Because in April of 43, another dozen at least are put on trial, aren't they? And also run foul of the People's Court. But what's really interesting is two of the men, her brother's been to the Eastern Front, so he knows what's going on in the way that Lanser knew what was going on in the East. The leaflets mention the mass murder of Jews. They talk about that, but also draw on German cultural tradition, German ideas of philosophical ideas. They draw on Thomas Newton, they draw on all sorts of people, don't they? I mean, it's fascinating what's in the mix, yes?
Yeah. Do you think we should just do a very quick kind of sort of 2-minute...
Yes, go on then.
What's it all about?
Yes, let's do that, yes.
All right. Go on. Fine. So the White Rose, the White Rose was absolutely a really broad network of individuals that took in students, but also academics and also individuals who were intellectuals, artists, who were basically oppositional to the regime.
Based in Munich.
Most of them based in Munich, but there was also a cell of the White Rose in Hamburg, and the leaflets made their way across Germany and also into Austria.
Yeah.
So it had quite a decent reach.
Yeah, into at least half a dozen cities.
Yeah.
But the later leaflets went a long way, didn't they?
Yeah, they went to Salzburg. I think they also went to Vienna.
And they wrote these pamphlets, didn't they? And there were sort of six of them, is that right? But then there was a seventh?
Yeah, so there were six printed pamphlets.
Right.
So there were four in the space of about 2 weeks in 1942, in the summer. There's then a hiatus because, as you said, Hans Scholl, Willy Graf and Alexander Schmorell, who were conscripted medical students, so they basically were sent in the university vacations to the front. So they go to the Eastern Front in the summer back
for your holidays. That's incredible.
Yeah, right, it's absolutely unthinkable.
I mean, that's not going to Thailand, is it?
No.
It's not backpacking on your gap year, is it?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so off they go to the Eastern Front for 3 months. When they come back, there's a greater sense of urgency, and so they write two more pamphlets, January, February of 1943. There is a draft of what would have been a seventh pamphlet, which Hans Scholl had on him when he was arrested, and this basically led to the arrest of Christoph Probst, who was another member of the group who had written that draft.
And what are the leaflets saying? They're calling on the conscience of Germans, aren't they? And saying this, we should surely must be ashamed of our German government right now. If we're decent Germans, are surely ashamed of what's going on. What's the tone of them?
They are fascinating precisely because they do a bunch of different things at the same time. And I always say this with the greatest of respect to my undergraduate students, but they're written by undergrads. They're written by students. Yeah. And in some ways you can see that. But they're basically trying to mount an argument to convince their readers to open their eyes to what's going on, and then increasingly trying to get them to take action. So they call on them to engage in sabotage, to engage in forms of resistance, and to confront what the Nazi regime is doing.
Yeah. And drawing on all sorts of German philosophical and literary tradition as well.
Yeah, so like undergrads
Again,
with all due respect to my lovely students, you know, we're all guilty of doing this sometimes. You know, somebody else has said it better, so you whack a quote in. And that's what they do. So the first pamphlet has a really long quotation from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe and Friedrich Schiller. Mm-hmm. So like totemic daddies of German literature.
Yeah.
These are the guys that if you want to justify your position as a German to other Germans.
It's if you were writing the British leaflet, what a piece of work is man, is what you...
Exactly.
You'd resort to Shakespeare and the King James Bible.
Yeah, that's exactly what you do. And so they grab Goethe and they grab Schiller, and they use those texts as a way of basically supporting the argument. So they write their own stuff first, and then the leaflet essentially ends with these big quotes. They then kind of surprisingly reach for a more diverse range of quotations. So they do quote from the Old Testament, but they also quote from ancient Chinese philosophy.
Okay.
Wow.
Which is fascinating.
Like most students, also just showing off their intellectual...
Well, isn't one of them a Buddhist? Am I right in thinking...
So Christoph Popp's father was really interested in Buddhism. I can't recall whether he... fact was, but he was really interested. He researched Sanskrit. He was not kind of towing the line in as much as, you know, there's a Nazi Weltanschauung, and that's what you've got to kind of conform to.
Where are they writing? Are they sort of getting together in their digs and kind of sort of going, here's a thought? I mean, how's it?
Basically,
presumably it's a conversation on the way back from Russia.
Actually,
isn't it?
This is a question worth asking. How old are they?
So they're in their early 20s.
Right, okay. So the absolute prime...
Yeah.
Student material. Yeah. And why are they of the mind to rebel? Because, you know, what I've read is they identify the fact that they're being, that German youth is being ideologically sort of kettled into ways of thinking and baked, as it were. And why are they, why do they possess the capacity to stand outside that or rebel? What's in there? Is it religion? Is it their upbringing? What's going on?
I mean, it's the $1 million question. Why do they do it when so many others don't? And why do they do it in the way that they do it? I think it's partly faith. They were all Christians of one denomination or another. And I think they take that very seriously to a greater or lesser extent. And it does make a difference to their sort of moral development. They're also all incredibly cultured. I mean, they play musical instruments, they read reams of literature and philosophy. They read Russian literature, which, you know, is not what they're supposed to be reading.
One of them speaks Russian, doesn't he?
Alex Shmerel, yeah, he was a fluent Russian speaker. His mother was Russian. He was raised by a Russian nanny in Germany. So, you know, obviously.
So he's able to talk to people on the Ostfront about what's going on.
Yeah, and he actually introduces Hans and Willy to the Russian people that they spend time with. So they engage with the enemy.
And as soon as you engage with them, you realise that they're just ordinary human beings.
Yeah,
like you and me, and they're not sort of...
Yeah, this propaganda... Exactly, the propaganda, the Nazi propaganda about the Soviets is just, you know...
But they're also against persecuting the Jews, aren't they?
Yeah. So they,
which is a sort of, you know, a really, really crucial point in the whole thing.
It's like a kind of... I think we can understand it kind of like an advocacy for others. Because the White Rose members themselves are not being actively persecuted, right? They're acceptable. The Scholls were in the Hitler Youth.
Yeah.
And rose through the ranks and were, to all intents and purposes, very enthusiastic. Willy Graf, who was one of the other students, he was more oppositional from an earlier age. He was Catholic. The Nazis banned all non-Hitler youth groups, which really wound people like Willy up, because there had been Catholic youth groups previously. But these were young people who were not being actively persecuted.
Yeah, so it's empathy for others.
It's stepping outside
their own direct interest.
Yeah, it's the prick of conscience to see other people suffering and to kind of put yourself in their shoes and to do something about it on behalf of those who can't.
One of the leaflets says, conscience is gives us the capacity to distinguish between good and evil, so which is as direct a call to moral arms as you could possibly have. I mean, one thing that's really striking in your description of why are they called the White Rose? That's the
scholars are divided.
Of course they are.
That could pretty much be my answer to every question on the White Rose.
So which tells you a lot. Isn't it the novel?
So it could be that Hans Scholl was reading a Spanish novel called La Rosa Blanca. It could also be a reference to the Virgin Mary. It could also be a reference to French revolutionaries wearing a white flower in their lapels. Hans Scholl is asked exactly that question in one of his Gestapo interrogations.
Right, still divided.
Well, yeah,
he's a bit vague about it, isn't he?
He's a bit vague about it in the interrogation. And also, you know, we have to be a little bit careful with those transcripts because they're being written by the Gestapo and not by the victims. But he's quite vague, but he says something like, you know, we wanted a name that would kind of feel like it might have something political behind it, but that wasn't sort of too political. So they want a banner to put themselves under, although they drop the name, interestingly, after leaflet 4. So when they come back in the January and make the 5th leaflet, they call themselves the resistance movement in Germany. So they kind of reposition themselves as something much more, up a notch, something that
much
suggests
more of a statement of intent.
Yeah,
and that's after Stalingrad, of course. So that one's
just before Stalingrad.
It's just before Stalingrad.
That's January.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So Stalingrad.
After the defeat.
The defeat of Stalingrad impacts on their activities as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Gives it greater impetus and relevance. I mean, one of the things that's really striking when we're talking about them is a thread that people often pursue when they talk about Nazi Germany. Is they go, how could this happen in the most cultured country in the world? You know, Germany's the most cultured country in the world. How did they? Which I really don't like this line of argument, because I always think that's junk, that way of looking. Germany's the most cultured country in the world. How did it end up? I always feel that that's a sleight of hand way of attacking culture. This is the idea that, you know what I mean? It's a way of being sniffy about culture. We don't need culture here, and it keeps us sensible. It's the sort of doughty John Bull way of looking at that argument, I think.
But also that somehow, if you're cultured, you're more moral.
But my point is, here are really cultured people, and their response is to say no, we can't have anything to do with this.
And also, I can give you a good example of this in relation to the White Rose, which is the Gestapo commissioned an academic at the University of Munich. So one of Professor Kurt Huber's colleagues was commissioned to analyse the pamphlets,
right,
just before the arrests. So he wrote this report, basically analysing the language as a way for the Gestapo to figure out who it was. It's like, you know, it's like
criminal profiling thing.
How amazing.
That is
and he is exactly the kind of guy that should have responded to the intellectual and cultural arguments in those pamphlets. He has the breadth of knowledge to understand the biblical references in them, the cultural references, the Goethe, the Schiller. And he identifies them all, but they don't move him.
They don't mean anything to him. Gosh,
so it speaks to him on an intellectual level.
Yeah.
But it doesn't.
But not on a moral
it doesn't
level.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, one of the things that's so fascinating about propaganda is if you say stuff... Well, I remember talking to Charlie Higson. He was saying that the secret of the fast joke was...
Repetition.
Repetition. You just say, today I am mostly wearing, and you just say it over and over and again, it becomes funny.
Yeah.
And
familiarity.
Familiarity. And it's the same principle, isn't it, with Goebbelian... is that a word? You know what I mean.
If it's
not,
it should be.
Of Goebbels. Yeah. It's repetition. And it's really interesting because a good friend of mine over in the US was telling me how... he's an absolute anti-Trumper, and his parents came up, and they are now retired in Florida and live on a diet of Fox News. And Fox News said that the problem with the Biden administration is all the food's going up, and turkeys now cost $90. And my friend was saying, no, that isn't true, and they wouldn't have it. So eventually he got out the wrapper of the turkey and said, look, it says $29, and they wouldn't believe it, even though there, in front of their eyes, was $29. So it goes to show that sort of sane people... all around the world, if you tell them enough stuff, they'll believe it.
And
this is what the Nazis are absolutely brilliant at.
Well, they're brilliant
at
culture. Not capital C culture, the opera.
They know how to tweak the right
strings. Well, yeah, and,
right,
and the conversation, the national, I mean, you could call it the national conversation. They're brilliant.
They co-opt things. They co-opt Goethe. They make Goethe a figurehead for the National Socialist cause, for nationalism. So it's then interesting when people like the White Rose repurpose that.
Yeah.
As evidence not of
the
correctness of the Nazis, but of the actual opposing view.
So, I mean, One of the things I think that interesting about the White Rose is they are regarded as the example of resistance in Nazi Germany. I can see you, you're bracing yourself.
I have to arrange my face.
They're seen as, as I said earlier, yeah. If you watch a program about the Nazis, you get them as the resistance.
Yeah.
But primarily because of Sophie Scholl.
And I think you're right, Jim. I think it's
because she's pretty and young, fresh faced, and she had a head chopped off.
And she's a woman.
And she's a woman. And it, so if you want your symbolism packaged up, it's right there for you.
And she's somehow. There's an innocence, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Because Kurt Huber was a conservative, middle-aged academic who was working at a state-controlled university. All four of the male students were conscripted.
Yeah.
Right? They were all on the front. They were wearing Nazi uniforms.
Yeah.
Sophie Scholl is the only one that you can actually, like, visually separate from all of that.
Yeah.
In a way that isn't actually a reflection of reality. You know, she was also studying at a state-controlled university. Yes. But I think there's something about Sophie being able to be separated out of that narrative in a quite reductive way.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because the Stauffenberg plot, the people always have to qualify it. They have to qualify him. They have to qualify who they are. They have to go, but actually, you know, they're all like rancid nationalists anyway. And what they want is a war on Bolshevism. They just want to stop fighting the Western allies because that's surely our common cause, all that sort of stuff. And so even the July plot has to be qualified and has to be. And you don't have to do that with the White Rose. With Sophie Scholl, as you've just said, the imagery of her allows you to not, you know, you don't have to show a photo of them in their uniforms to talk about the White Rose. With Stauffenberg, you're stuck with the fact that, you know, a lot of the people around are pretty unsavory. He's no saint, is he? So does this mean, and this is, we're drifting now towards your briar patch, does this mean that where do the White Rose sit in German self-view of a cultural self-view of the Second World War?
I mean, the White Rose are already being commemorated really early. So even before the end of World War II, they're being talked about on the BBC German service. Right. So Thomas Mann gave a speech in the summer of 43 about you know, praising Hans and Sophie and Christoph for their act of bravery, which in a way is remarkable. There are already two novels that are published, one in German, one in English, right after the end of the Second World War, about the White Rose, or based on the story of the White Rose. So there's something I think really interesting about how this group starts to get institutionalized in cultural memory really early.
Yeah.
Inga Scholl, one of the siblings of Hans and Sophie, she published a book called The White Rose in, I think, 52. That also served to really kind of cement the role of the Scholls, particularly. You know, we're talking about Sophie being a figurehead for the movement. That's partly how that happens. Yeah. And then, of course, Germany's divided. So the reception history of this group is necessarily quite different. They're commemorated quite centrally in East Germany, which I think in some ways is quite surprising. Yes. You know, they're very middle class. They are the educated middle class. They are intellectual. They are not, you know, what marks them out as an inner German resistance group is that they're not communists.
Yeah.
And yet they can be utilized in East Germany.
They're sufficiently anti-fascist, though.
They're anti-fascist, so it's okay.
Yeah.
And you can elide a bunch of stuff. You know, you can just let a bunch of stuff go and it doesn't matter. I think in West Germany, they become especially important because they tell a different story about what happened. You know, in post-war West Germany, we develop a narrative about collective guilt and responsibility and perpetratorship.
Yes.
As public knowledge of the extent of the crimes of the Holocaust becomes known. So to have an example like the White Rose allows us to see in that context something that is almost redemptive.
Yeah. We're going to take a very quick break and return to that thought, because James is champing at the bit to say something, as am I.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, Was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Caddy, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Boxing Day here at St. Edmund Hall, virtual Boxing Day. And we're talking about the White Rose. Jim, you had a question, go on.
Yeah, well, I was going to say
that... So the redemptive quality that the White Rose offers West German people in the 50s and 60s is where we'd got to.
Yeah, I suppose I was almost going to make a sort of counterpoint, which is that it just goes to prove that you don't have to fall in line with the Nazi way of thinking, because clearly there are people who don't.
Well, straight back at you, not very many. Is the other thing it offers evidence of.
Yes, not very many. But you know, the whole argument is did the Germans have a choice? You know, were they just brainwashed? You know, were they all in a kind of stupor for 12 years? This is the counter argument on that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, where's the line? And I was saying to Al earlier that, you know, I'm always extremely conscious as a Germanist. As a what in German we call an Auslandsgermanist, so literally someone who does German studies from beyond Germany.
Yes.
Right. I'm British. I have no German connections, and so I always feel quite sensitive, especially when talking to students who don't, you know, who can't understand how this was possible.
Yeah.
You know, how do you navigate that? And I think a useful way of doing it is to just turn it back on yourself and your own social context.
Yes.
Right? Even though it's not comparable in lots of ways, we don't want to draw reductive historical parallels. But there is a danger when we look at that period of history and we ask those questions that we kind of judge it with an ahistorical moral view.
Yes. Well, I mean, it sort of points at that question that, you know, what would I have, on the rawest level, which is, and this is a popular cultural question, what would I have done?
Exactly.
And everyone assumes, everyone says, well, I'd have resisted.
Yeah.
Everyone, of course I would.
Obviously, of course, the riposte is the hell you would.
Absolutely.
But yeah, you look at, you're like, well, obviously that was evil. You know, obviously I would do something about that.
Yeah, yeah. Self-evidently evil, isn't it? So then where did the... Because after all, as you've said, Germany's divided. And then and Germany remains divided ideologically, socially, politically. And then isn't anymore. So where do the White Rose then, you know, where do they bob up in the sort of, in the new Germany? Because, you know, in the many Germanies.
Yeah, in the Berlin Republic of post-1990. I mean, so in the early 2000s, there was this little boom of films about Nazi Germany, basically all sorts of different films. So Downfall was probably the most famous. But there was also a film about Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. And that was really popular and I think did a lot to kind of revivify the White Rose in the kind of popular imagination.
Yeah.
Also, there were a number of documents that were discovered after the wall fell. So that film was also able to kind of legitimize itself by saying, you know, we're using new real evidence. Transcripts, we've got real evidence, you know, these are the real words of these historical actors. Interestingly, it puts, again, Sophie Scholl front and center, which I think we welcome because, you know, how many stories are we telling about women in the resistance? Not that many. but at the same time, it risks reducing
all, it's her brother initiates the... She finds out about her brother and joins the group, isn't it? Is the way round the actual sequence
that's
of events?
That's the most likely sequence of events.
Yes, of course, because we don't know.
There are suggestions that she knew about it earlier, but that seems to be the most likely. Yeah.
That film then brings the story back, recenters her, and there's a load of because I think Downfall's an interesting movie, you know, because he's a Swiss actor after all. They don't cast a German because you're not going to be able to.
It gives it some distance.
It gives it the necessary gap you need. Yeah. And it's presented as, if you're watching Downfall, the thing is, I can't imagine what it's like to be German watching Downfall in the early 2000s, 10 years after a reunited Germany.
Saw it in the cinema when it came out because I was on my undergrad year abroad living in Germany. And I've never, ever been to a film where there was silence at the end. So when the credits rolled, everyone just sat in silence in their seats.
Wow!
It was astonishing, and I've never experienced that.
Did you talk to anyone about it?
No, I mean I would go to the cinema by myself to watch all these World War II films because that's what I thought was interesting. I was clearly gearing up for my future life, but it was just stunning. It was, you know. So that, I think that's what it and was then, probably like, you know, for Germans watching it.
Because I think that obviously, there's the meme scene now.
That's Wein Buffet.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. These things escape, don't they?
Yeah.
And that scene's escaped the film.
Yeah.
To the point where the directors keep trying to get it shut down, that meme, but it's escaped. It's run off. The scene in the film where the Goebbels family are murdered. You know, that's I think the bit in the film where we escape carpet chewing Hitler. And if anything, it's metaphorical, isn't it? This is what Germany's done to itself. Mm. This is what's happened in the country. And that's towards the end of the movie, I think it's an incredibly powerful and upsetting moment in a way that some of the Hitler scenes almost feel like they're almost played for entertainment. He's crazy and he's out of touch and he's ridiculous and absurd and they're in the grip of the madman. Mm. Whereas those later scenes show what the madness actually amounts to.
Yeah, it's the consequence.
Yeah. Like I said, I can't imagine what it's like being German watching those. And you have that Ausländer Germanist distance.
Yeah.
What do you think was happening in Germany at the time that there were those films? What was going on culturally?
So I think in the early 90s, culturally, there was a lot more focus on reunification.
Yeah.
And there was a lot more kind of turning towards interrogating the recent divided past. And then around the mid-90s, you get a couple of quite high-profile works that are examining the role of perpetrators. So it's an interesting almost return to that kind of collective guilt argument of the West German post-war period. And then in the early 2000s, that shifts again, and you get this huge surge of publications and TV programs all about the idea of Germans as victims of World War II. So Germans suffering as a result of the Allied bombings, the advance of the Soviet army, which is a really fascinating shift.
Yes.
And then German resistance has to somehow be positioned within that. But there's a huge amount of criticism of that German victimhood discourse for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But then, Alex, you then get a dozen years after Downfall, you then get Look Who's Back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which everyone loved. I mean, you know, it sold millions. It was almost like there's a collective sigh of relief that actually we can laugh about this.
German comedy, though.
That's exactly the next thing I was going to bring up.
I mean, because it is incredible how popular it is, and it is incredible how popular documentaries about the Second World War are now in Germany.
Oh, yeah.
I've done so many for ZDF.
It's like Guido Knopp, who was basically pumping out like Hitler's. There's a comedy song about Guido Knopf and how he produces all these Nazi documentaries like Hitler's Hitler's Helfer, Hitler's Frauen, Hitler's Letzte Sekretärin.
Well, I've been in some.
You see.
You can get a big sort of glossy book about kind of, you know, pictures of Messerschmitts in. You can get that published in Germany. You can get a kind of sort of absolute bilge, but popular narrative history about the Second World War as a British historian, you just can't get it done. The only person I know of who's published over there is Anthony Beaver. Max Hastings isn't. No one else is.
Really?
No, just not for love nor money. I'd give them to publish, but they
they won't do it. Won't do it. Worth the paper, Jim.
Not worth the paper. Can't be doing it. No, don't want to know. And actually, I'm quite nice about Germans. Maybe that's the problem.
Maybe that's your problem. Yes, indeed.
I'm quite generous to some of those U-boat captains.
Yes, you are. Quite generous to those U-boat captains.
You know, I draw the line at Hitler, obviously. And
I mean, when you're teaching this, what do how do students, modern students, because it's a thing we've talked about a lot on the podcast over the years, is, you know, I was born in 1968. I grew up in the 70s where it was war films on Bank Holiday Monday, Airfix, Action Man, a sort of khaki glamour, the Battle of Britain movie, you know, those very strong cultural currents. Our grandparents had all done something in the war. My mum would go on about there being no bananas, you know, that sort of thing.
You're putting too much butter on your toast.
Exactly, and all that, and clean your plate, and, you know, we had to eat the family rabbit and all this sort of stuff, right?
Family pig, in my case.
Well, they're clearly doing better than... anyway, but someone born in 2005...
Yeah,
they're even younger. Exactly, they're even younger than I can possibly imagine. Where do you pin their set of cultural references? Because, you know, I have two grown-up daughters. They did A-level history, so they did A-level Nazis, and they stop in 1939. There is no Second World War, so no. you could tell them it went in any direction, and they'd believe you, right? Well, because, you know, they're on the Nazis are on a roll in 1939. It looks like things are going well for them, the way the A-levels taught.
but isn't it all Call of Duty and Netflix?
Well,
but
there is also Call of Duty and Netflix series. But so if you've got a student, this is a very going around the houses with this question. If you've got a student from 2005, how do you get them to locate the war culturally? Because you talked about them as undergraduates. Is that how you do it? You say, here are some students, here's the pickle they're in, here's what they're doing?
Yeah, I think we come at it... I mean, the White Rose Project has come at this really through translation, principally. So, you know, one of the things I teach more than anything else is translation from German to English. And so the White Rose Project was originally conceived of as a translation project to translate the White Rose resistance pamphlets. And I think, like I said, you know, I work on German culture. I'm interested in how stories from the past are consumed and transmitted through film and literature and museums. And that's also what I'm kind of mostly doing with my students. And we're doing that kind of through this filter of translation. So we're looking at the original German material, but then we're...
There's the fridge again.
It's great, that fridge.
As long as we tell the listeners.
The bar's not even open.
It's a tragedy.
So we're doing this through translation, and we're finding ways to kind of transport these stories, these lives, these ideas from German into English. And that process in itself necessitates a huge amount of engagement with, you know, historical fact, but also, you know, what are the books that the White Rose are reading that might influence the way that they end up writing or the quotes that they use. And I think the students that I work with on the project are pretty critically aware about the way that stories, historical narratives, get packaged up in Netflix series, or, you know, I think they're quite canny, actually, this generation, in a funny way, and in a way I think that we sometimes don't expect.
Yes.
I think they are quite canny about the need to interrogate, you know, they know what fake news is, and they know they've got to navigate it.
Well, and particularly with a story that's has been presented baldly as heroic. I mean, the one thing we're told to question culture now is heroes, isn't it? The idea of the idea of heroes.
Heroes and icons.
Heroes and icons. And, I mean, we keep touching on it. Sophie Scholl is iconic.
Absolutely. She's in Madame Tussauds in Berlin.
Is she?
Yeah, she's next to Anne Frank.
Because, you see, it's very interesting, because I was going to say... when you talked about her sister writing a book in like 52, you know, the Anne Frank memoir diaries are out quite early in the 50s, aren't they?
Yeah, although interestingly, Anne Frank's diary in West Germany is popularised not through the diary, but through the stage play adaptation. So it's interesting that actually it's an adaptation of her own writing that makes her popular. Initially in the West.
I mean, it's interesting. There's been some interesting series and films recently, haven't there? I mean, you think about sort of what was translated as My Generation War, for example. Yeah, okay, that's making you smile. So tell me why.
Generation War.
Is it problematic?
Gosh, yes, it is. It is problematic.
So for those who don't know, this
Jim,
is...
Jim, we just managed to get an academic say problematic. Yeah, we've done
really
very well.
That's really good.
You've got a bingo card.
No, no, I think we need to draw
for
one
those
up.
Who don't know, Generation War, I think it was called For Our Fathers, For Our Mothers or something
in
Germany.
It's Our Fathers, Our Mothers, yeah.
It's a six-hour mini-series about five friends, of which two are brothers.
I couldn't bring myself to watch it.
And... it's pretty, I mean, it's pretty hard-hitting stuff. And inevitably, one of them's Jewish. Two of them are girls. One of them ends up being a nurse. One of them ends up being a kind of floozy to an SS commander, but to try and save her Jewish boyfriend. The brothers, one of them is a sort of, you know, a wimp and doesn't
like
want to go, but becomes hard. The other one is a sort of slightly more idealistic, kind of good sort who becomes an officer, but gets disillusioned, has a kind of mental breakdown, and ends up in a punishment battalion. And it doesn't end well for... two of them, one of whom is she guillotined or shot? I can't remember, but anyway, but it is pretty hard hitting stuff.
Yes,
but it sounds like a series of parables.
Well, there's all sorts of buts, because also it sort of it's making them seem much, with the exception of the younger brother who becomes very very hardened, it makes them seem much more kind of nice and sort of wannabe shoals rather than.
I think there were a lot of criticisms of that series, but it was also criticised for how kind of innocent those central characters were being made to be, and that's kind
I suppose
of,
that's the sort of what I'm driving at, really.
It's the sort of, yeah, that their apparent, again, it's quite a it's attempting to mount quite a redemptive.
But television can't help itself with redemption. It's that's a like a, you know, that's what strike that's what stands out about programs like, say, The Sopranos or Mad Men, is that they abandon the idea of redemption. Whereas most standard television drama, they're absolutely desperate to redeem everyone, and characters, no matter how dreadful they are, in the end, they're good people, really.
But
Tony Soprano and Don Draper, in the end, are ghastly shits, and because people are like that, and there isn't an attempt to turn them, to make them digestible. And what that sounds like is an attempt to make the Second World War a digestible learning experience from which we can all grow.
But it's interesting because it's, you know, the title is, I think it's Unsere Mutter, Unsere Väter, it's Our Mothers, Our Fathers. But that's already positioning this in a very specific way in relation to a young generation that's watching it, which is sort of misleading in the English title. There's more distance if you say, oh, Generation War, that's got nothing to do with us.
It's a terrible
if
title.
You say it's Our Mothers, Our Fathers.
Yeah,
it's really interesting.
Well, because that in its own way, you know, when Americans talk about the greatest generation, they mean their fathers, their mothers, their grandparents. Don't they? That's what they're saying. So to actually call it unsere Mutter, I mean, that's quite on the nose, isn't it?
And I mean, what I would say
and it's also that idea. Poor old Germany got caught up in this thing. Poor old Germans got caught up in this sort of
these
thing
are just innocents, pawns, in a bigger thing.
Hypnotized and beguiled by Nazism or whatever.
So there was a sociological study in the early 2000s where they interviewed multiple generations of the same family and asked them about war stories and what the second generation knew and what the third generation knew. And one of the guys who worked on this study said something to the effect of, you know, the narrative that you get from a young generation in Germany today is the Nazis all arrived on a big spaceship and then the Third Reich happened and then they got back on the spaceship, they flew away and everyone was a bit embarrassed. Which is a good, I think, is a
that's
good,
a very good
metaphor
very strong,
for
well, it's that
an approach.
Book, that graphic novel Heimat that we looked at. Yes.
Years ago, I'm writing about that. Yeah,
which is really, really interesting.
Nora Krug.
Yeah,
where she basically pairs apart the stories the family have been telling themselves. Now, grandmother says, you know, we used to drive for this guy who was a Jewish bloke, and I don't know what happened to him. And you know, Nora Krug investigates this and finds everything that her family have been saying about what happened in the war is nonsense. It's all ghosts and phantoms.
And there is so much of that in contemporary German culture.
Well, it's really interesting because a few years ago I was involved with a BBC series called Lost Home Nazi Movies or Lost Home Movies of the Nazis like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, the reason that came about in the first place is because what's happening is the kind of sort of current generation, kind of sort of two generations down, are going through their attics of their grandparents and finding all this stuff. Or their parents who've hidden it when they cleared out their parents' houses. And they're suddenly going, what is all this stuff? Ooh, I don't want anything to do with it. And so they're handing it into an archive. And so there's these little film archives all over the place in Germany, just stuffed full of film footage taken in the first years of the war when it was absolutely plentiful. There was loads and loads of these little mini movie cameras all over the place, and everyone was encouraged to do it. And of course, what you realise is A, some of this footage by, you know, we're not just talking all sort of SS types, we're talking kind of Wehrmacht and all sorts, is pretty horrific, frankly. And of course, it's being sent back home to be developed. So the idea that the vast majority of people haven't got a clue what's going on in the East,
or wherever,
yeah, is just frankly ridiculous. The original point I was going to make about Generation War, for our fathers, for our mothers, or whatever it is that Blake Snyder, you know, the legendary screenwriting guru who wrote Save the Cat, the great guide to Hollywood screenwriting, I think he'd be very pleased with Generation War because he would say it would tick every single box.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's
my point. It's television. It is drama television. Shapes.
Yes, and this shapes is this is but this also applies to something like Saving Private Ryan, where you've got something which on one level is incredibly realistic. The depiction of action and all the rest of it, yet historically is incredibly problematic.
Yeah, it's a simulacra of realism. It's that it's a suggestion of realism,
right?
To, in order to tell a story,
yes.
Rather than and you know, stories are the great trap, aren't they? In all cultures,
but because the action sequences are amazing.
Yeah,
that's it.
But it's like a kind of simulated authenticity.
Yeah,
there's
simulated authenticity.
Right,
I love that phrase.
But. I mean, in my first book, I talked a lot about this German concept called, it's basically emotionally experienced history, or felt history, which makes it sound
What's
like
the
history
German
of felt.
That, please?
Gefühlte Geschichte.
Gefühlte Geschichte.
Oh, nicht schlecht, oder?
Oh, I love that.
It just sounds better, doesn't it?
Everything just sounds better in German.
Everything sounds better in German. Certainly, concepts all sound better in German.
Yeah.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Abstract nouns are strong in German.
Beautiful, yeah.
Yeah.
Go on, carry on, sorry.
But this, you know, this kind of emotionally experienced history, that there's a sort of turn towards this, right? So it's like we're saturated with facts. Now we want to know what it felt like, which is a symptom of the fact that we're about to move into a post-witness era. We're about to not have survivors from the Holocaust. We're not going to have eyewitnesses. We're not going to have new testimony.
Yeah.
And there seems to be
something... But there's plenty of old testimony, original contemporary
of old testimony
that no one's actually looked at.
Yeah, of course. But I think there's a real sense within contemporary German culture, there's a real awareness of that shift about to happen. And there's this fascination with what it was like for people to live through it. So I think that's why films like that have such a resonance, because they are giving you that kind of like bird's eye view, no, not bird's eye view, the opposite, worm's eye view, yeah, of, you know, what it's like in the trenches, what it's like in the kind of nitty gritty moment of fighting.
As best as cinema can, with lots of noise and
jump cuts
and exactly. The visceral confusion of the image and all that sort of stuff.
Because it can do it in this really sensory way,
yeah,
which is not the same as when you
read a book.
Yeah.
You sit down and read a book, and it was very noisy. Like that.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
You'd be fine.
Yeah. I mean, that's where you want literature, because then literature can create that sort of sensory, realm.
And after all, history has always occupied a semi-literary space anyway. I mean,
yeah, of course.
This is the thing that, again, you know, history. The truth about history is it doesn't. Academia sort of owns 5% of it, maybe. The Academy owns possibly 5% of it. 95% of it is off reservation. Is in the culture. Is culture. It, you know, is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves,
yeah,
who we are, where we're from, what we're about, what our values are, in a way that, I mean, talking about the dissolution of the monasteries on a primary source level will never touch.
Yeah.
Can never touch.
And you don't do Tudors, though.
No, I don't do Tudors.
Oh, I thought we were going to do the Tudors today. So disappointed.
Moving swiftly on to the Reformation.
Oh, we're not going to do Luther.
But that's what I mean.
I've been to Wittenberg.
But that is, that was, so have I. And then I went somewhere else. But this is the thing about history, isn't it? Is that, you know, we've started on the White Rose, which, because of its the iconic status of Sophie Scholl, sort of exists well away from history. Exists in culture, yeah, in imagination, exists, and is a story. Again, it comes back to that. If history is the story you tell yourself about yourself, one of the things, James, we've talked about this a lot, because it's one of the things you've really pushed against, is that the Second World War, the Battle of Britain, there's the story we like to tell ourselves about the Battle of Britain, is this plucky little Britain, just a few pilots were hanging on in there, and somehow we overwhelmed the mighty all-conquering Luftwaffe, and we saw them off, Jim.
Yeah.
And it's, that bears no relation to what happened. At all, this is the real, the, I think, the interesting thing about history, as much as the things in history are interesting, where it sits in cultural space is the fascinating bit, right?
Absolutely. And I don't know if this is a tangent, but when I was doing the Chalk Valley History Festival, I grew up in Salisbury, and I suddenly realised that my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was born the same year as Sophie Scholl. And so I was like, I've never really thought, you know, I've written a book all about these resistance fighters, and actually Sophie Scholl is the same age as my grandmother at all of these moments. So I looked into it, and she was in the ATS, and she was fire watching in Salisbury Cathedral Close the same time that Sophie Scholl is off doing the pamphlets. Goodness. And it's things like that where, you know, I have an absolutely, I would say, kind of classical British sense of World War II from growing up and from the kind of consumption of culture, of British culture, that, you know, these are the stories that we tell ourselves about the Brits in World War II. And to have to then, you know, reposition that, not only within the historical reality, but also a kind of reality of other perspectives on the same thing, I think is... it's fascinating.
It really is. It really is. But just go back to Look Who's Back. For those who don't know, this is a common novel. Well, no, because it seems to me it's such an important shift in German culture and at a time. I mean, when's it come out? 2013, I think it is. And this novel.
Yeah,
imagines.
I was in Berlin when it came out.
Right.
I read it in Berlin. I read a translated copy in Berlin, and, you know, would sit in the bar of the posh hotel reading it. On a Kindle, though.
Did you put it inside, you know, something more respectable?
Yeah, 20 shades, 50 shades of grey.
But the novel is written in the first person by Hitler, and it imagines that he, you know, between the last days in the bunker to 2013, waking up in a car park, it's just a blank to him, and he doesn't understand. He's got to sort of navigate his way around the kind of modern Germany. And it's very, 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 very funny. But it's also laughing at ordinary Germans as well, isn't it? That's the sort of the whole point. I mean, how did that happen, and how has that been allowed to be so popular? I mean,
I'm trying to work out what I think about this. I mean,
what does that say about modern Germany? Does that say that they're sort of slightly coming to terms with it? They're kind of relaxing about it a little bit? They're kind of sort of a bit easier in their skin?
I'm not sure relaxing is quite the right word. I mean, there was during COVID, there was a lot of anxiety in Germany around the emergency laws that were brought in with lockdowns, right? And there was a case of a young woman who likened herself to Sophie Scholl at a sort of anti-lockdown rally. She was called Jana aus Kassel, Jana from Kassel. And this blew up on the internet. It's meme central. Right. So you can look it up. But there was a lot of anxiety around that. And even the foreign minister kind of waded into the Twitter war about it. And that was a good indication, I think, of actually how the sensitivities around the way that period is talked about, they still exist. That's why I'm slightly kind of hesitant about this word relaxing. But I think reunified Germany is very reflective and very self-critical politically and culturally about that period. Yeah. We saw it in the refugee crisis, you know, Germany taking in more refugees than any other European country. I think we can interpret that as, you know, a direct result of Germany's mid-20th century history. So when something like Look Who's Back comes out, you know, it's a provocation, but I think in a good way, and I think that there's a space where it can be interpreted like that, right? Yeah. That actually we should laugh at Hitler. We should be able to. I mean, the White Rose mock Hitler in the pamphlets. Yeah. You know, there's a fine tradition of it, and it is. I mean, whether or not we're ready to, you know, the Germans are ready to laugh at themselves in the way that you're suggesting the book does, I don't know. It's certainly mocking the kind of media culture.
Yes. Well, yes, because I mean, if people don't know, I mean, this is we'll go straight into a spoiler. So the Hitler wakes up basically at the site of the Führerbunker, goes over to a newsstand, makes friends with a guy on the newsstand, and he's in his uniform, and they think he's hilarious because he's carrying on like Hitler, and he becomes a comedian, and he becomes famous on the telly, and he ends up generating a political movement around him, is the plot of the book, isn't it?
Richard Herring certainly did Hitler moustache and wander around.
Yes, he did that for a year. I just hadn't really put those two things together. Richard's a good friend of mine, and for 1 year he decided, and he, whenever anyone asked him what the moustache was, he goes, it's a Charlie Chaplin moustache. And they go, no, it's not, it's a Hitler moustache, mate. He goes, no, it's a Charlie Chaplin, I've grown a Charlie Chaplin moustache. You know, these moustaches were really, really fashionable, especially on comedians. And he did a whole show about it. He had a Hitler tash for a year, and the poster for that show is basically one of those sort of, it's one of those sort of Hitler portraits of him looking sort of stern and a man of destiny, one of those pictures. It's worth looking up. And he went, lived in Shepherd's Bush and would go to the shops with this, with the Hitler moustache. And his whole thing was to see, is it time yet for us to be able to laugh at this moustache, or even just wear this moustache? What are the consequences? And he had an awful lot of people who wanted to smash his face in. Yeah. I mean, it's
good. So I think the answer is no, they're not ready.
Well, they weren't ready here in London. That may be 20 years ago. I mean, the thing is Rich at that stage was doing these, you know, the show the year before he went on 50 dates and wrote about it. So, so you know, he was trying.
That was the obvious next step.
Exactly. The obvious next step was growing it in a moustache. Alex, thank you so much for fascinating hour. And because, I mean, before you got here, Jim, we touched on, you know, we've spoken to Katia a lot. Katia Hoyer, who, you know, her thing is that she's writing about Germany, not in Germany. And that she feels that gives her room for manoeuvre.
Yes.
But that in itself is an interesting idea, because are there German, is there an Auslander Englandist? Is there someone in Germany writing about British culture? Because David Edgerton, he makes a really interesting point about the history of the Second World War. He says, at some point, British historians have got to start writing about Britain as though it's a foreign country. So you talk about nationalism in a context of nationalism as we understand it, rather than filtered through party politics, British party politics. And you've got to look, why can't we look at the Second World War in the way that we examine the Soviet Second World War or the German Second World War? Why aren't we doing that? When can that happen? So is there a German historian? Do you have a German equivalent? You know, an Auslander Englandist or whatever.
Someone who's looking at, you know, British leaflets dropped on the...
And saying, how do they relate to Dad's army?
Oh, I hope so.
Well, I hope so, because it's this element of detachment that you don't have a horse in the race, as it were, in terms of German culture, gives you this freedom of maneuver. Yeah.
I think there is, and this has been said to us about the White Rose Project and the work the students are doing. There's a kind of a lightness that comes with that distance, that you can approach the history without a certain amount of baggage that you might otherwise have. Yeah. And I think it is that always being really critical, right? Always interrogating everything and every aspect and taking nothing for granted. Yeah. So that, you know, what's the point of doing all this? Well, presumably so that we learn something. Yeah. And the White Rose wanted to change the world, you know, so maybe we can learn a bit about that.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. Thanks everyone for listening. We hope you have a merry in between Christmas and New Year time and a prosperous 2024. Cheerio, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.